What happens when expanded unemployment benefits expire next month? We've got a preview from some of the states that shut them down early, plus a look at running your family like a business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Avon, Colorado, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, August 5th. Good to have you along. Let's start with jobs. The Labor Department said today that first-time unemployment claims fell last week to 385,000, continuing a gradual decline we've seen in the past several months. But that still leaves nearly 13 million Americans getting some kind of unemployment assistance, most of them through one of the pandemic-related federal programs. And that's after 26 states pulled out of those programs early. Remember, the idea was to encourage more people to go back to work. Marketplace's Samantha Fields looks now at what really happened.
It's been over a month since many states stopped participating in the federal unemployment programs. And so far, there's no evidence that cutting off those benefits has led to more people going back to work.
What actually happened is states that ended unemployment benefits early had a slowing down of hiring compared to states that had kept unemployment benefits in place.
Ray Sanza is with the payroll processing firm Homebase, which found employment actually fell about 1% in states that ended the federal benefits and rose more than 2% in states that kept them. UKG, another payroll processing firm, found something similar.
States that didn't end the benefit ended up growing their workforce activity about twice as fast as the states that did.
Dave Gilbertson at UKG says correlation is not necessarily causation here. Many of the states that are still participating in the federal programs were hit the hardest by the pandemic recession, and so had a lot further to go in terms of hiring. But even so,
it was very clear in the data that the expanded federal benefits really were not the reason that people are not returning to work.
One of the main reasons many people are still out of work is childcare, says Rebecca Dixon at the National Employment Law Project.
Lots of camps are still closed. There's the issue of, are schools going to reopen in person?
And of course, there's also the Delta variant and the fact that in many states, COVID cases are rising again. Meanwhile, the expanded federal unemployment benefits are set to expire everywhere in a month. Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation says that's premature.
It's certainly going to complicate people's financial stability, their housing stability, and we know that it will slow economic growth.
Because, he says, it will take a lot of consumer spending out of the economy. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, variant. What variant? We'll have details when we do the numbers. The Senate is still hammering out the details of that massive infrastructure bill, with members trying to add or block amendments. And at least for those who support the bill, sell it to constituents back home. The White House has released a state-by-state breakdown showing where money could go for roads, bridges, broadband, and other projects. But folks in Washington aren't the only ones involved in the negotiations. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Lobbyists, they live for mega bills like this. It's a lot of money, touches multiple sectors of the economy, and has the potential to direct billions of dollars to a particular issue or industry. Melissa Holzberg tracks money and politics at the nonprofit Open Secrets.
We've seen about a 36% jump in lobbying clients on infrastructure from all of 2020 to the first half of 2021.
And that was before there even was a bill. Mostly big players like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers. Now that there is a bill, smaller groups want a piece of that pie, too. The digital advocacy group Fight for the Future is trying to change language affecting cryptocurrency. Executive Director Sarah Roth-Gaudette says they're facilitating calls between their supporters and senators.
Tons of people started calling. At one point, we were getting 500 calls every half an hour. At the moment, we're seeing close to 9,000 completed calls, and the number's just continuing to go up.
But it is a 2,700-page bill with hundreds of groups trying to make tweaks all at the same time. Kevin Mills is with the group Rails to Trails Conservancy, which advocates for better walking, hiking, and biking trails.
So we're certainly doing all we can to make sure that what the Senate decides in the immediate debate is favorable to these issues.
His group says it's pushing for more funding, but he says if it doesn't happen,
we don't really fold up our tent and go home. We look at what the next possible steps are.
Like the potential for a reconciliation bill. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
President Biden signed an executive order today setting a target for the transition to electric vehicles. His administration is calling for half of all new cars and light trucks sold in the U.S. to be electric, hydrogen fuel cell, or hybrid by 2030. Yes, that's less than a decade from now. And if you have questions like how realistic is that target? And speaking of infrastructure, what will it take to power all those vehicles? Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has answers.
50% sounds like a lot, given that only about 2 or 3% of cars sold in the U.S. today are electric vehicles or EVs. Jessica Transic researches energy systems and transportation at MIT.
It's certainly an ambitious goal, but also I believe can be achieved. And part of the reason I think that is that we're also seeing announcements by major companies, automakers, that are setting comparable goals.
So automakers are on board. What about consumers? Christopher Harto, who follows sustainability policy at Consumer Reports, says he thinks interest will grow because
battery prices are expected to come down rapidly over the course of a decade, making EVs cheaper than gas-powered vehicles sometime, you know, within the next 5 to 8 years.
And when you drive an EV, even a hybrid, you also save money on gas. There's still a lot that would need to happen to make that 50% goal work, though. Like, we need more chargers, especially the fast ones.
These are the chargers that can recharge an EV in, you know, as fast as 20 minutes.
Those would be placed along major highways
to allow people who own EVs to feel confident that they can go on longer trips without running out of charge.
He says the U.S. also needs more chargers in cities for people who don't have a driveway or garage but still need to charge their cars overnight. This executive order aside, there is $7.5 billion in funding for electric vehicle charging infrastructure in the bipartisan plan. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
If you're looking for even more economic news, might I recommend the Marketplace Morning Report? Start your day off right with David Brancaccio and the gang. Raising kids involves making lots and lots of decisions. Should they eat more vegetables? Can't hurt. Do they need more sleep? Yeah, probably. Are they getting too much screen time? No comment. A lot of these questions have no clear answers. Emily Oster is a professor of economics at Brown University and a mother of two kids. In a new book, she writes about how parents and caregivers can approach those gray area decisions through a data lens. It's called The Family Firm, a data-driven guide to better decision-making in the early school years. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to actually start with the subtitle, because I would describe my own parenting style as winging it. And I think a lot of parents and caregivers would probably agree with that. Why do you argue for a data-driven approach?
So a lot of the argument in the book is about using data, but also about thinking about our lives in a more structured way and maybe not always winging it. If we do that, I believe that we can end up in a situation in which we were happier. I think we often make individual small decisions rather than looking at the big picture and saying, you know, hey, how often do I want to be spending my afternoons at some kid's sporting event?
This is your third book. You've also written books about pregnancy and about caring for babies. The Family Firm focuses on elementary age kids. And I wondered why this is an age that is different in terms of parenting decisions.
So I think there's two big differences. One is simply the role of logistics to manage a lot of planning, which is different from maybe having a small kid.
Mm-hmm. I'm nodding vigorously here.
Yes, you're nodding. Exactly. I think the other big difference is that the decisions that families face are just really different in this time frame. And so often we are facing decisions which we didn't expect. And so some of what I'm trying to provide in the book is more of a way to decide than a particular decision to say, you know, hey, here's a way to make them with a structured framework that may help make them better.
Yeah. So let's break down one of those issues. I think one of the thorniest that parents of kids this age face is, you know, when to give them a phone and what kind of phone. Can you walk me through how you use data to approach a dilemma like that?
Yeah. So I think the first step in all this decision making is to frame the question, you know, in that case, like, why am I getting them the phone? And the answer to that will tell you a little bit about what kind of information you need. Well, then you get into a second step of fact finding. Actually trying to figure out what does the data say about whether this is a good idea. And the data can tell you things like this is what to be on the lookout for. But ultimately, you have to think, is that a kind of concern I have with my particular kid? And then the third step is to make a decision. I urge people to say, okay, this is the date at which we'll decide and we'll make some decision and then we'll try to move on. And the last step is really, and I think particularly relevant in the phone case, is to acknowledge that you could change your mind.
Hmm.
And that gives you a little more freedom almost to experiment with what works for your particular situation.
You talk about how data can be useful in solving the sort of gray area issues in parenting, even when the data itself isn't perfect or when, you know, the advice from experts is constantly changing. And I think the pandemic has been a prime example of that. How does your approach work when, you know, we don't really know yet whether kids should wear masks, whether to get the vaccine once they're eligible? Those things are still being sorted out.
Yeah, I mean, I think the uncertainty is the hardest thing. And the pandemic has really laid bare the cases in which not only is the data not very good, but there may just literally be none of it.
Right.
And that means, you know, that sometimes we have to make decisions in a very, very data poor environment. But that, in my mind, that is an argument for structured decision making rather than for just doing whatever, because it at least tells us what data we would like to have, and it gives us a way to make the choices using the data to the extent that we can.
The book is called The Family Firm because, you know, running a household is a lot like running a business. But as the pandemic has made more clear, a lot of that labor falls to women, and many women have left the labor force during the past year and a half or so. Can you talk about some of the tools that you use or recommend using to make that labor more manageable?
So I think that there are a lot of practical things like task management software or shared Google Docs, which, you know, seem a little, I don't know, clinical maybe, but can actually help to share these burdens a bit more. If we've decided there's some set of rules for what people can have for lunch or rules for something else, it shouldn't be the case that only one person can implement that.
Yeah. For people who don't naturally have the skills that I think you obviously bring to this through training, but also a personality, you know, I know the spreadsheet parents and I know the parents like me who are like making decisions as they come up and just trying to keep our heads above water. How can you coach someone to actually change their approach if they're not naturally inclined that way?
I think that for some people, they will read Family Firm and they'll be like, oh, this is what I'm looking for. Worksheets, spreadsheets, a structure, like this is for me. And for other people, they'll be like, boy, this seems like a lot of work. But I would say that there may be individual pieces in here that will resonate with people. There may be something where you pull out and you say, huh, maybe we would benefit from thinking a little bit more carefully about how many birthday parties we want to be going to.
All right. Emily Oster wrote the book, The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early Years. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And if you want to talk about business and the economy with your kids, we've got a podcast for that. It's called Million Bazillion. New episodes out now, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. coming up.
Are they really able to see what I bring?
There's more than what's on paper. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 271 points, just shy of 0.8% to finish at 35,064. The NASDAQ picked up 114 points, also just shy of 0.8% to end at 14,895. And the S&P 500 added 26 points, 0.6% to land at 44,29. So how did automotive stocks react to those electric vehicle targets Marielle told us about? Ford picked up 2.9%. General Motors added 3.25%, and all-electric Tesla pocketed 0.5%. U.S. retail sales in July were 10.9% higher than a year earlier, according to MasterCard's Spending Pulse, which tracks online and brick-and-mortar sales regardless of the form of payment. MasterCard's chief economist attributed the increase to pent-up savings and the new child tax credit payments. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.22%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. This week, regulators in California approved an emergency order restricting water use in the state. More than 5,000 water rights holders in Northern California and the Central Valley, most of them farmers, will face shortages amid the state's ongoing drought. It's not just farmers who rely on access to cheap, abundant water. California is home to the country's largest manufacturing sector. And as KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb reports, the textile industry in Los Angeles is facing some tough choices.
Sean Zahedi thinks about water a lot.
Without water, I mean, you can't really make fabric, to be completely honest.
Zahedi runs Lafayette Textiles in the city of Vernon with his father. It's in Los Angeles County.
Yeah, it is so water intensive, and obviously it does translate into a higher cost of manufacturing, especially here.
And especially when water costs go up, something that California has seen over the last decade. Right now, 85% of California, including LA, is experiencing either extreme or exceptional drought conditions. Those are the highest levels there are on the U.S. Drought Monitor scale. And if things keep moving this way, the textile producers and dye houses that remain in California could leave, something Zahedi says has already started to happen.
My dad, actually, at one point, he had 250 employees, had a dye house, had this knitting, all that, and then basically had sold off the dye house. That dye house actually went to Nicaragua.
Zahedi's 55,000-square-foot factory now employs just 20 people.
The industry has totally changed.
Ilsa Metchek is the president of the nonprofit California Fashion Association. 30 years ago, she says, the U.S. fashion industry employed some 900,000 people cutting and sewing fabric. The workforce is now under 100,000. Cheap labor in other countries and recent revisions to free trade agreements, Metchek says, contributed to this decline, but so too did California's water-saving measures during the last drought. Back in 2015, former Governor Jerry Brown implemented the first mandatory water cutbacks in state history, a 25% reduction for 400 of California's water districts.
And if you're in a dye house, the water has to run all the time. That is not a problem in Mexico,
where water conservation rules are rarely enforced. Now, some textile companies are already planning for a future with less water. Take the denim company Sitex, which just opened a facility in L.A. Its founder, Sanjeev Ball, says he's invested in denim washing machines that recycle water.
As you're washing or using water, you're recycling it simultaneously. It's not going outside into another plant and getting treated and, you know, being either disposed or recirculated. It doesn't work like that.
It's as much a business decision as it is a moral one, Ball says. After all, the World Bank estimates about 20% of the world's wastewater comes from fabric dyeing and treatment. But upfront costs for this equipment, Ball says, are high.
This $2, $3 million, whatever we put into it, we broke even in 7 years.
Still, he says, that investment will pay off in a drier future. In Vernon, California, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb for Marketplace.
We heard the latest on weekly unemployment claims from Samantha Fields up top, and tomorrow we'll get the big job numbers for the month of July. But even with all the help wanted signs out there, the skills a company wants don't always match up with the ones job seekers have. And some people can live in this gap for a very long time. That's the case in this installment of our series, My Economy, about a cookbook author and caterer trying to keep her family together.
I'm Nandita Godbole. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm a cookbook author and a food writer and a freelancer. And I also have a small business called Curry Cravings. And we're looking at a strange little transition out from Georgia to California. So in 2008, with the recessions, my husband found himself without a job. The burden kind of shifted on how are we going to make our mortgage payments and how are we going to make things happen. One thing led to another, and I crowdfunded my first cookbook, and the success of it led me to continue to work in that space, knowing that I wasn't going to easily find a job. My husband received a job offer in California. So that was 2010 when he started commuting back and forth. And when we got him settled, we found him a place to live and said, all right, you're going to do this and we'll manage back in Georgia on our own till we can come join you. We actually just, observed 11 years of him being, working for his California employer. And he loves his work, but we still have not been able to go out there and be with him. I'm trying to find a job just so that I can be around my family and we can all make the transition and be out there in California. But when I apply for jobs or I look at jobs, I realize they're looking at, you must have a bachelor's in marketing or a bachelor's in something, anything other than landscape architecture or botany. And it's kind of funny because I look at it and I see the job description and I can do probably 85 to 90% of the things that they're asking on that posting. They are going to judge my resume. They are going to judge my cover letter. But are they really able to see what I bring? We have some changes coming up with our daughter going to college in California. So now it's, out of the three of us, it'll be two people in California and mom's back in Georgia and, us debating what that means. But it's just not working. And it's hard to be in this space.
That was Nandita Godbole, cookbook author and caterer living in Georgia. Let us know how your economy is doing at marketplace.org/myeconomy. And this final note on the way out. Buying a house hasn't been this out of reach in nearly a decade. That's according to the latest Housing Opportunity Index from the National Association of Home Builders and Wells Fargo. Just over 56% of the new and existing homes sold between April and June were considered affordable for a family earning the median national income. That's down from 63% in the first quarter of the year. And you know this, higher building costs and not enough homes for sale are the big culprits. Now, we can quibble about what affordable really means. The index assumes a family can spend 28% of its gross income on housing, though we know millions of households spend far more than that. That's it. We got to go, but not before your Thursday moment of economic context. The Wall Street Journal reports that ExxonMobil is considering a pledge to go carbon neutral by 2050. Yes, considering. Activists and investors have been pushing for a bigger commitment from the oil giant to reduce its carbon emissions. In the past, CEO Darren Woods has called such pledges by competitors, including BP and Royal Dutch Shell, nothing more than a beauty competition. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Amy Scott. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.